Good morning, counsel. This is the case of State versus Russell, and we will begin by introducing members of the court, and then we will recognize counsel, and then we will argue, or you will argue. I am Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and by order of seniority of service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
I was muted. I apologize. Good morning, Stephanie Stacy.
Good morning, Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik. Good morning.
And John Friedenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. Mr. Lewis, are you with us here today?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Good morning to you. And Mr. Conway, are you with us here today?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Yes, I can. Good morning, Your Honors. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you. Good morning to you. One of the reasons we introduce everyone is to make sure we can all hear each other. And I think we are very ready to go. Then, Mr. Conway, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sean Conway, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Stephen Russell. This is a post-conviction appeal and involves the question of whether Mr. Russell's trial counsel, Mr. Miller, was ineffective for failing to file a direct appeal after Mr. Russell requested, both by letter and by phone messages, voicemails, instructing his counsel to do so. But really, the fundamental question here, and the question this court hasn't addressed head on before now, is whether the district court was clearly wrong, whether they committed clear error in finding that Mr. Russell didn't prove, by that preponderance of an evidence, that he notified counsel he wanted to appeal when there wasn't also competent evidence presented that Mr. Russell did not do so. And that's the important crux here. That's the turning point. Was there any competent evidence presented by the state that Mr. Russell did not do so? But the law here is pretty well settled, right? But following a trial, conviction, and sentencing, if a defendant's counsel deficiently fails to file an appeal after being directed by his client, counsel will be deemed ineffective.
Mr. Conway, your client received an evidentiary hearing, right?
He did, Your Honor.
And he testified, right?
He did, by deposition, yes.
It's never been the rule in this state, has it, that a trial court is bound to accept the testimony of a witness?
Absolutely true. Yes, Your Honor.
So if the trial court did not believe your client, doesn't the outcome follow?
But I don't think that's what the it is, if that were the case. But I do not believe that that is the case here. Because really, the point of law that we're dealing with and the testimony that we're dissecting from that point of law is, in those post-conviction cases where there's some evidence that a defendant directed his or her attorney to file a direct appeal, and we do have some of that evidence here, right? We have a date-stamped, notarized letter sent by Mr. Russell to his trial counsel within that 30-day time period, well within that time period. We also have his testimony.
Was there any evidence about the like a copy of the envelope or something from the mail log from the institution or anything like that with regard to that letter?
So Justice Friedenberg, Mr. Russell's testimony was that he followed the applicable protocol when sending that letter, which is he wrote it, signed it, he dated it, and then he had the D&E or diagnostic and evaluation librarian notarize it for him. He then put it in a mail slot. So he's not, it appears from that testimony, he doesn't actually have access to the mail room or some way to get a date-stamped copy of the envelope of that letter.
All right, I apologize. My question probably wasn't clear.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Was there any evidence in the record beyond his testimony to show that that occurred?
There's the notarized letter, right? We've got that February 3rd, 2016 letter that's been notarized. And notaries are important, right? We use notaries for affidavits. We use notaries for other court documents because that's what gives it the authenticity the courts desire. And his burden is to show by a preponderance of the evidence that he wrote that letter and sent it. And I think that notarized date stamped letter, coupled with his testimony, Justice Frydenberg, that he followed the protocol at D&E, put it in a mail slot, is sufficient to raise that inference. So then the question,
in the absence of other evidence beyond the testimony, doesn't this fall back to credibility determination by the trial court that we give deference to?
Well, we should give deference to the trial court. However, we do it in fairly specific circumstances. And this is the crux of the case, and this is what we're getting at. And that is that when there's some evidence presented by the defendant that he did these things, right? That he notified his counsel that he wants to appeal, the trial court doesn't commit clear error, finding that the same is not sufficiently established when there is also competent evidence that the defendant did not ask his or her attorney to file that appeal. When there's also competent evidence that the defendant did not do so, right? And the cases that this court and the Court of Appeals have decided before involve testimony from trial counsel where they affirmatively stated, I didn't get notice from my client that he wanted to appeal. I know he's testifying to that. I never received that message. I never received any sort of notification at all. Whereas in this case, unlike all those others, we have significant ambiguity. We have trial counsel, Mr. Miller, admitting to the fact that he may have received those voicemails and that he just was not aware of it. That he may have received that letter, but he just wasn't aware of it.
Was that phrased in the term of possible? With like the question, was it possible that you received that? Because I believe the record says that he says he does not recall receiving a voicemail or a letter.
Question, is it possible that Mr. Russell has called and left a message to speak with you during the 30-day period between when his sentencing was and when it expired, or do you know for sure? And then answer, sure, it's possible. That's Mr. Miller's deposition at page 9, line 9. So he answered, it's possible. So that's significantly different than the other cases that this court has dealt with and the Court of Appeals has dealt with before.
Can we really say there's no evidence, no competent evidence to the contrary? Isn't it some evidence that Mr. Miller testified, I don't remember getting a voicemail, I don't remember getting a letter? You know, maybe it's not as strong a testimony as, you know, I definitively say I didn't, but he's saying he didn't remember it. Isn't that at least some evidence that he wasn't notified that your client wanted to appeal?
Well, Justice Papik, I would say that the standard of preponderance of the evidence is one of the lowest burdens, right? We have to show more likely than not that Mr. Russell presented some evidence. I don't know that we can say that that is some evidence that Mr. Russell failed to notify him about his desire to wanting appeal, just that he doesn't have any idea. So either the preponderance of the evidence standard either means what it means or it doesn't. And it doesn't appear in this case that the district court really gave deference to that preponderance of the evidence standard or what the actual evidence was that was put forth at that evidentiary hearing, which was that we had a client who gave testimony that he left several voicemails, both at the Douglas County Correctional Center and when he was transferred to D&E. And we know that because he was very, very specific with his facts. Right. He didn't just say, yeah, I called him. He said, look, the day after I called him, I was in Mod 20, which is the maximum security mod at Douglas County Correctional Center. And I know that because I talked to another individual who said that I should reach out for an appeal. We then have him transferred to D&E, where he states that he made two more additional phone calls with voice messages between the 9th and the 13th of February of 2016. So we've got that specific information coupled with the fact that Mr. Miller admitted that it was possible that he received those voicemails, and the affirmative statement by Mr. Miller that he was clear he never advised him of his right to an appeal, either before the plea hearing, between the plea and sentencing hearing, or after the sentencing hearing. And it's not that he's required to do that in all circumstances, but that information coupled with the fact that he says it's possible he received those phone calls.
Your client is not claiming he will wasn't aware of his right to appeal within the appeal time frame, correct? That's not part of this appeal.
No, he does claim that after he was brought back to the Douglas County Correctional Center after his sentencing, he was made aware of that. Plus, there is the statement by the court on the record of that right, I believe.
So that would be part of your ineffective assistance counsel claim for this. It's the fact that the counsel was directed to appeal and he didn't follow that direction. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's the focus of this appeal. And really that's what makes this case unique. You know, we don't have this situation where we have less than affirmative testimony to answer Justice Papik's question, in which there's not also competent evidence here presented by the state that the defendant didn't do this. And his remedy is a limited one, right? He gets the remedy of the right to appeal his conviction and sentence, which he should have under the circumstances, considering the fact that it was clear that we met that preponderance of the evidence standard at the trial court. We know that this is a high burden at the appeals level, but this is the kind of case that rises to that level based upon the ambiguity of trial counsel's testimony. So we would ask the court to remand this to permit the defendant to file his direct appeal. And with that, we would submit if there are no other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Conway. Mr. Lewis, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Matt Lewis, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Nebraska. This is Mr. Russell's appeal of the District Court of Douglas County's denial of his motion for post-conviction relief following an evidentiary hearing. As covered earlier, Mr. Russell assigns only that the District Court erred in making that denial for not finding that his trial counsel was ineffective for failing to file a direct appeal despite his alleged request to do so within 30 days of his sentencing. The issue argued by Mr. Russell is that he presented evidence at the evidentiary hearing, which he believes establishes, at least in some way, shape, or form, that he notified his attorney of his wish to appeal. Addressing the definitive, sort of evidence or some evidence versus competent evidence, the evidence that was presented at the evidentiary hearing was purely the deposition of Mr. Russell, the deposition of his trial counsel, and then this signed notarized letter. The deposition of Mr. Russell claims that there were phone calls made, that there was at least one voicemail message left, and that there was also maybe potentially some other phone calls to his attorney to try and get that. But
if I may, with respect to the letter, what would a prisoner do to obtain in the course of the handling of mail in this confined situation? What can the prisoner do to obtain an external stamped or canceled or envelope that would enhance the claim that it was indeed mailed? How does that work in real life?
I'm not exactly sure how that would work in real life as far as getting a copy of the with a stamp on it that shows that it was sent out in sort of the metered mail. However, I could imagine a situation where, don't just photocopy the notarized letter, but you could also photocopy the envelope that you put the letter in, at least to show that it addressed to the right person, to the right address, that can show a little bit more about whether or not it's one thing to present a letter, and it's one thing to make allegations or claim that I made phone calls and left voicemails, but did you mail the letter to the right person at the right place? Did you make the phone calls to the right phone number? Were you calling the correct office? It would be hard to show that the letter was actually, like a tracking number or something like that if it was
UPS. Right, right. But is there something else internally that might have enhanced his verbal assertion? I don't know, money off his books or anything like that. I don't know how it really would work at that institution.
And I'm, to be honest, I'm not familiar with, how mail is accounted for within, DOC, but I would imagine, something that shows that either, postage was purchased or that, if there's some sort of mail log where they're screening the mail that's going in or out, something along those lines, or maybe even, a statement from somebody that works near the mail slot, if the librarian who also served as notary, as talked about by Mr. Conway, if they happen to see him, you know, after the notarization, you know, go put the mail in the slot. Just something a bit more than I swear I sent a letter and I swear it went to the right place. I mean, then you start getting into a credibility argument of, you know, the attorney saying, well, I just didn't receive anything. There's nothing in the case file internally in my office that shows that anything was received, call, letter, notes, otherwise. So I think that it kind of creates just a you know, a bare credibility argument, and the district court in this case obviously sided with counsel, his Mr. Russell's trial counsel.
There's no requirement the supporting documentation has to exist to support his testimony, is there? If the court finds the testimony credible in itself, that's sufficient to carry the burden, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I believe it is. Aside from the other, the testimony of Mr. Russell, there's also the deposition testimony of his trial counsel. And I would just like to revisit a couple of points there, given the statements that were made earlier by the appellant. He says that, he sends an appeal rights form only if contacted after an appeal for sentencing usually, but, you know, he doesn't typically discuss those rights in a negotiated plea case such as this. And then he says that he doesn't recall receiving phone calls or letters from Russell about an appeal. Now, he says that it's possible there was a phone call, but he reiterated again that he recalled no letters or calls and didn't have any documentation in the case file that indicated a desire to file an appeal, nor did he think that there was any issue, given the fact that this was a negotiated plea, that Mr. Russell would actually want to appeal this case, given the rights that are waived during the plea hearing, and the only thing that left is sentencing. And the district court covered this in its order to a degree about, you know, the fact that there wasn't a non-frivolous sentencing appeal issue that really seemed to be throwing itself out there, or was asserted by Mr. Russell either, given the fact that in Mr. Russell's own deposition, he says, yes, I spoke with my attorney about the sentence that I was looking at. He told me it was going to be around 70 years max. I understood that going into the plea. In, you know, good order, Mr. Russell is then sentenced to 60 to 70 years in jail. So the sentence is understood by Mr. Russell, as according to his deposition, it's within the statutory guidelines for the offense that was committed. We don't have access to the sentence.
Russell would have requested a direct appeal, or you know, it was found that he had.
Mm-hmm.
The frivolity of that issue would have not precluded the, or not would not been a reason for the appointed counsel not to file the appeal, would it?
Not necessarily, but I think it's laid out by this court in State versus Wagner, where there is no counseled appeal rights, then the analysis sort of turns into, whether or not a rational defendant would want to appeal, for example, because there are non-frivolous grounds for appeal, and that this particular defendant reasonably demonstrated to counsel that he was interested in appealing. So I'm just, you know, trying to fill out, I guess, some of that analysis and what was looked at by the district court in deciding that it was going to deny the post-conviction relief requested by Mr. Russell. This evidence was reviewed by the district court during the evidentiary hearing, and it found that Russell failed to prove that he was actually interested in an appeal, and that the appeal desire was actually received by Mr. Russell's trial counsel. And in light of the case cited by the state, Barnes, Deckard, Wagner, the state submits the district court's denial of the relief sought by Mr. Russell was not an error. If there are no further questions, the state asks the court to affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
38 seconds,
Mr. Conway.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think we need to make sure we focus on one very, very important point. And that is, this court doesn't second guess credibility determinations. And if the district court had found that Mr. Russell was not credible, I'd be hard pressed here asking you to find that that is clear error. It would be a pretty high burden. But here the district court didn't do that. They did not put in their order on page 23 of the transcript that Mr. Russell was not credible. Just that trial counsel was not informed about his desire to want to appeal. But all of the evidence that was presented completely disputes that. And there was no competent evidence presented on the other side that he did not do those things. And so for that, we ask that the court reverse and remand this case so that he may file his appeal. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments on State versus Russell. Counsel, you are excused.